Hello.
And welcome back to This Is Not
a History
Lecture.
It's been a couple weeks for us.
It has.
A normal amount of time for y'all. A
chaotic couple weeks for us. Well, I don't know about you. Mine was chaos.
I've had some developments.
Ooh.
That I haven't told you about.
Do we need to do our little intro first?
Yeah, we have a lot to hash out.
In that case, this is episode 136. Today, I will be talking about the invention of dynamite.
It's 137, isn't it?
I can't count. Yes, it's 137. It's episode 137. I will be discussing the invention of dynamite and Alfred Nobel.
Very cool. Nice.
Thank you. What will you be talking about today?
I am going to be doing a bio, because I haven't done a bio in a while. Ooh. About a woman named Chavela Vargas.
Oh.
So
she's not know that one.
Hispanic. And it's Hispanic Heritage Month as of 2 days ago.
Yes, it is.
So, yeah, I thought I'd do a fun little bio.
I didn't think about that because I did my research when I was on the plane.
It was a while back, yeah.
Yeah. Dang. Okay.
Okay, we got time.
Yeah, I still got time. Okay, we've got time. Time. Yes, thank you for the reminder. I will adjust accordingly. Well, it is a nice weather here in Central Texas for once. By nice, not 105. Still a little toasty in the sun, but
yeah. I mean, it was 76 earlier, and I was like, oh, I bet it's really nice outside. I go outside, it's like gross and disgusting.
It was very humid. Yeah,
and like, and I was like, 76 though.
But this town got rain, and when I was home with my family in Dallas. We didn't get any. And I was like, the one time I'm not in Central Texas.
And we got a lot of rain while you were in Dallas.
I'm so mad.
We got like 3 days of rain.
I know. I literally like, I came back in the porch of the place I'm staying in. Like it was stained. Like the landlord yeah. stained it while I was there or while I was gone. So I wouldn't have to, you know, avoid my apartment for 48 hours. And I came back and there was like water on the ground. And I was like, oh, did the stain drip? And then I was like, no, it was just water, which
was so like not used.
I was
the
like,
the first
what
day
is
that
this?
It rained, like pretty good all day long. And the ground is so dry that even though it rained pretty consistently all day long, there was like no standing water anywhere.
That's sad.
Like I had to walk across like a big chunk of grass to get to my car after work. And like I usually that grass if I have to park over there, like usually I'm like, oh, my shoes are gonna get wet. Nothing. And it
of
had been raining
not.
All day. And I was like, wow, that is really rough.
And then 2 more days of it apparently y'all got, and I got none. But it's okay because we get to talk about history and that makes everything better.
Depending what kind of history you're talking about.
Oh, that is true. Well, they can find out what kind of history we're talking about if they stick around, because
this is not a history lecture with Kat and Kaylee.
Oh, man. So
y'all are hearing from us, and this is the first time we're really hearing from each other in the last 2 weeks. It has been, I don't know about you, it's been very busy, very chaotic. I'm on my end. How about you?
Yeah, about the same. Yeah. Do you want to know why?
I'm very curious.
I know why yours was busy.
I was gonna say everyone. I told everyone before that I was going on a trip and flying alone for the first time. So I did all that. I did that. Yeah. What's up with
yours?
Seems
like you survived, so that's good.
Barely.
Oh my goodness. My iPad is talking to me. Shut up. So since you heard from me last to now, I have interviewed twice and gotten a job.
What? What? Oh my god! You got the job. Ooh. I'm trying really hard not to scream into the mic right now. You did? How? Wait, what?
Yeah, well, yeah.
They missed your interview. They HR messed up. Okay.
Yeah.
So in the months that it took HR to mess up that many times, they missed your interview multiple times.
Yeah, and they like literally didn't call me.
And then within 2 weeks, they give you two interviews and a job.
One of the second round, I literally got a call on Monday and they were like, okay, can you do Wednesday?
Oh my God. Well, oh my God, congrats. That's amazing. Okay,
you.
I'm just a little, what? That was fast. I honestly, because of the way HR has been, I thought I was going to have to be like,
so I have not officially heard from HR that I got the job, but
okay.
I have heard from the people who hired me and said, yes, we want you, that, hey, you've got the job. So I don't know if, like, HR, if according to HR, I have the job yet, because I haven't heard from
them.
I'm
sure they had to green light it and say it was okay.
Well, they have to, like, well, yes, yeah. And, like, the committee makes the decision, and, you know, they make the decision, and then they tell HR, hey, we want to hire this person. So, but yeah, so I was thinking about the timeline on this. It was kind of crazy. So on Thursday the 7th, I had my first interview. On Wednesday.
Oh, so right after.
Right, like, they were, right, okay, after you left.
I left. Because the day before, the day I left, my last day, I drove immediately from work to Dallas. Mm-hmm. The day I left, I stopped by your office a couple times, couldn't find you. I was like, she's probably busy. She's probably doing other stuff. And then I was like, I hope by the time I get back, she's at least heard from HR. But you straight up got a job.
I know. I was like, I could text Kat, but I feel like this is more
no,
fun.
This is in-person. This is in-person news.
So, yeah. So, I'm looking at the calendar now. On Thursday the 7th, I had my first interview. I hated that. My dog just stuck his tongue way out.
I heard it. I just heard it.
Oh, my God. He's such a cool man. Anyway. And then on Wednesday the 13th, I had my second round. And then on Thursday the 14th, they told me I had the job.
Wow. They really did move fast.
Yeah. So how it worked was there were 3 interviews that first week because they have to interview at least 3. And they gave a second round to me and another girl. Okay. No idea who she is. I just know it was a girl.
What, dude, now you're getting in the line. Oh, my goodness.
All right. Okay. My dog likes to, like, hurt himself on wires that no other creature would hurt themselves on. Anyway, so my second round interview, which was a presentation, was at 12:30. It was 12:30 to 2:30. And then the other girls was from 3 to 5. So on that Wednesday.
Okay.
So I was thinking that they would decide on what Thursday, like, mm-hmm. meet as a committee and then decide then and maybe tell me on Friday. But apparently they stayed late and decided that day. Cause my boss was like, hey, we have a meeting with the HR person at the museum specifically. And I thought she meant, like, the hiring committee had a meeting. And then she's like, no, dummy, me, as in you and me, have a meeting with. Yeah, so they called me in, and, like, my boss, and then, like, my boss's boss was there, and, like, the HR lady. Aww. And they were like, congrats. And I was like, oh, yay. So, yeah. So that was cool. I am officially an employee and not a temp anymore, which is weird because I've never not been a temp.
We do want to clarify. This job is the one that Kaylee has been doing.
Yeah.
She's not moving cities, states, anything like that.
Same job. It's just a permanent position and not a temporary position. So I am officially hired.
Oh my God, congrats.
Thank you. I'm glad that that's done with.
I was gonna ask, do you feel like it's a weight off your shoulders that's just been there for like a year?
No, because I don't stress out about those things like you do.
Yeah. Valid.
I'm more grateful that the hiring process is over. It's like, it's weird because it is the same job I've been doing,
right?
You know, so it's just kind of like, okay, I guess I'll keep doing it.
Carry on. Yeah.
It is kind of cool because I feel like it's not that I was ever like not embraced, but like now it's like I'm really a staff person. Mm-hmm. Like I have all the rights and privileges and everything of other staff people.
Well, and all those little things that you like technically were not allowed to do as a temp, but mm-hmm. would have made the job so much easier. Like having access to certain resources, like
ordering stuff from Amazon. So all of that stuff. All good things. And then there's like certain things, like, you know, people are expected to be on committees, and I'm like, oh Lord, I have to like be on a committee. Like, what is being a real full-time employee mean,
right,
like at this museum? So it's gonna be good. I'm excited. I do think that I killed them a little bit in a good way with, because, you know, like the question at the, like when they're like, do you have any questions for us? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of like you don't have to say anything, but if you have a good one, then that's like your last impression.
And that's the one they like prep you for that question. Uh-huh. That's like, yeah.
So I came up with one like literally during the interview, and it was one that I was like genuinely interested in, but then the whole committee was like, that's a really amazing question. So I was like, yes.
Oh, yes. Nailed it.
I asked them, because to be clear, even though like this job I've been doing for a year,
mm-hmm.
and for all intents and purposes was promised to me,
mm-hmm.
they still could have very much not chosen me.
Yeah.
Like that was still completely an option and was very much on the table. And I definitely approached this process with that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
But I asked them, what has working at this museum taught you?
Oh, which I like that.
They all were really like, oh.
I like that question a lot. Because so, it should be a learning experience.
I'll keep
experience.
That one. It yeah. should be. I'll keep that one in my back pocket, especially in a museum. Come on.
Yeah, I was about to say, museums are just about learning.
Yeah.
So that's yeah. fantastic.
So I came up with that on the fly.
Nice one.
And I was pretty proud of myself. So very if you need nice to use one. That, there was a free good question for you at the end.
That is a good so. One. Yeah. Yeah, I've heard a few good ones, and a lot of them, like, that you hear when they're prepping you for it are more, like, business-oriented lesson, like, questions, like, how do you respond to your employee feedback? Like, what changes have you all made as a business that didn't, like,
right.
like what do you wish you'd known?
Boring ones.
Yeah. ones that, like, they work for business stuff.
I was
going to
say, they
not,
work for other fields.
They're not
yeah.
as much for museums, because yeah. museums are a very different space. Mm-hmm. That's a really good one for a museum.
So... I was like, I honestly didn't think twice about it. I was like, oh, that would be good to ask because I was genuinely curious, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because it's like all people I know on the hiring committee. And so I literally was like, well, since I'm not in this situation often, I figured I'd take advantage of it.
You.
Yeah, I do have a question, actually, because yeah. how often are you going around asking your coworkers,
mm-hmm.
what have you learned from working here? I guess you could, but it doesn't really like...
I probably would, well, but that's a different situation.
Yeah.
I have no holes barred.
You're a special kind of coworker, Kat.
I'll literally just plop down in someone's office and be like, what's the meaning of life, yo?
Like, oh my God. Okay, let's move on.
Now, there were a few times that like I asked that kind of question, but no, that's not one that you're right. Yeah, that's not one that you normally get to just ask.
Yeah.
So that's a good one.
Well, especially in that kind of setting where yeah. like, you know, it's... Obviously, there were five of them interviewing me, and, you know, like, while I have this audience here.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So
and especially in an institution like that yeah. has the background and history of that institution, mm-hmm. it is something you want to pay attention to.
Yeah. So, and plus it's like a big reason of why I made the decision to stay at this museum and not look for other things is I realized myself that I still had stuff to learn from this museum, and, it had a lot to teach me, and so I was wondering if other people felt the same way. Yeah. So it came from a genuine place and not of a let me get a good question in, they're gonna like this.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so that's enough about that. I now have a real actual job.
Congrats, it's amazing.
Which is really good because I was like, I don't know. My mom was like,
here.
What are you going to do? And I was like, I'm moving with y'all.
Honestly, while I was home this week, I was like, you know, this is nice. I don't have to worry about anything. And then I was like, no, but I would
well,
if I was.
Yeah, you would. And my parents, like, y'all have room.
Yeah, we have rooms. And I know your room got converted into your dad's office.
There's no room for me.
Like, that's true. It wasn't. You're. Grandparents, great grandparents took your room, and then your dad's office became your...
No. My great grandparents took my parents' room.
Okay,
they took my old room.
Gotcha.
That's how that happened.
Okay,
and like my brother moved out, so there's like a little bit more room, but there's still not enough room.
When you're home, you stay in your dad's office, right?
Yeah. Well, now that Zane's room is available, I will sometimes stay with him or stay in his room, but his old room. My mom.
Ew.
And she made it cute. No, don't worry.
Oh, okay. I was gonna say, I trust yeah. your mother.
So like technically there's room, but there's really not, especially for all my shit. Cause I've been, you know, furnishing an apartment for myself for the last
right.
several years and not one bedroom in my parents' house. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of stuff.
Yeah, Kaylee yeah. and I were just talking about that, and I've had that too, where I went from a decent sized one person apartment, not really a decent size, a college sized one person apartment to one room now, and I'm like, there is still stuff stacked up in my childhood bedroom that's just a pile in the corner.
Yeah.
And that's, I feel like it's that way until you get your first, like, house or your parents move and need you to, like, get rid of all your stuff and you just chunk it.
Well, I still have a few things, but actually where I'm in right now, where we're sitting in right now, this is a really, I have a lot of room here.
It is a very spacious apartment.
I know. It really is.
Especially and compared I'm very lucky the, what the we were average in before. Is. Well, the average, too, for our
for like area a one bedroom.
Of, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have more space than I need, actually. And I'm kind of, I don't know how to fill it up. But I don't want to fill it up because I know I won't be here for forever. And I won't be in this space forever. You don't know if you're going to be able forever. To
downsize after the next one.
Yeah. So yeah. I'm almost like nervous to like buy a bookshelf or whatever. Yeah. But, you know, Facebook Marketplace is a blessing on this earth. And I can always sell it.
It is. And I would like to note that Kitty is currently holding my foot with his foot. And it's making me so happy.
Very nice. I'm glad he settled down. He just, as he's gotten older, he's just like very uncomfortable.
I just can't move now.
So.
This is the closest to cuddling any dog gets to me these days. Oliver hates me.
Oh, man. He's a lover. I will say that. So.
Well, congrats. That's amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. So how was everything?
Chaotic. Good. I was so far out of my realm of comfort. Like, not just, like, traveling alone was a first. I was out of my tax bracket for all of it.
Mm-hmm.
I will never stay at a hotel that nice again in my life. Like, I it wasn't paid for by me. It was paid for by... an entity connected to my new job, and it was one of those moments where I was like, I will never be able to afford anything this nice again. Yeah. Like 10 US presidents have stayed there, tons of like famous people. It was a 5-star hotel, and I felt it was so cool, but I did feel a little out of my element, and like every interaction I had, I was like, was that okay?
Yeah.
Is this all right?
Yeah,
but it was really fun. Took the time a couple days to drive up to DC from where I was in Richmond. It was 2 hours drive there and two hours back, but we left early enough to basically be there every hour that the Smithsonian's would be open. So I booked myself through as many of those as possible, made it through 4, and even then I didn't get to see all of everything over 2 days.
That's ambitious. You know, like, D.C., when you do museums, that's, like, all you do on that vacation.
Oh, that's all I did for 2 days was just museums, and I still
2 days is not barely enough.
Made it through 4. I didn't make it through 4, to be honest. I had to leave early from one of them. But, no, 100%. Like, I was talking about it with so two of my coworkers were there, but we, like, split up. So there was one day when they went to Williamsburg, which I was like, oh, I really want to go to Williamsburg. But I was like, I kind of want to go to D.C. more.
Yeah.
So through the whole process, though, I made some acquaintances, networked. And within that network, there is a couple people who are not in the same institution that I'm going to be in. But through a mutual, like, benefactor fund / thing, collaborative. We're like sister museums, almost. And they were very open about, you know, we're not... Those of us here are not necessarily trained the way that you are with your master's degree and your training and everything. And I was kind of pointing stuff out to them around the historic building we were in. And they're like, are you okay if we request a grant to bring you up here again and do this, like spend a week doing this with us, going through these artifacts and telling us these things and helping us document all the stuff that we don't know how to do and we don't know the terms for, and, you know. They were like, we can't date a textile by looking at it, but you can. And I was like, sure. And within the next day, I got a call from someone else who was like, would you like to come back to Virginia? We'll pay for it. I was like, I would love that. So I might go back up there for a little while on another little work trip sometime. And I was like, this is the gift that keeps on giving. So the networking went great. It seemed that it seems like something that's going to breed a lot of opportunity.
Cool.
And I decided that if I get to go back up, I will be doing the whole, they call it apparently like the trio or something like that. It's like Williamsburg, Yorktown, and, but yeah, so I'll get to do Williamsburg hopefully if I go back up there soon. But for the time I was there, I was like, I do want to hit the Smithsonian's. So I did them on my own.
Yeah.
Which was so, so cool and so fun to like get to go my own pace. Because I know most museum people are not, or most people are not museum people, and they aren't going to stand there and marvel at, oh, wow, this display is done very well. Look at the glass on this. It's non-reflective glass. Like, you know. So that was just really, really cool. And I like stopped and talked to employees at the museums, and like, it was just like really, really fun. And it kind of made me feel like a big grown up. And that was the cool thing. I think it was like the best way I could have traveled alone, but not alone. It was because there was always someone there to like fall back on if I needed something or wanted to grab dinner with someone. But I was very much independent while I was there. So it was like a really good introduction to traveling alone. And I kind of feel more confident coming out of it. And I'm really glad for that.
I know the first time I went through an airport by myself, it's like, oh, this is okay.
Yeah, it was like, I can do this. Yeah. I definitely had leaving. My anxiety was terrible. And I want to give a shout out to my dad. My dad is just the best. And I love him so much. He I was ready for him to like drop me off at the airport. And, you know, it was DFW airport. So I was like, he'll drop me off. He'll have to speed away to get out of the traffic and everything. No, that man parked, took my suitcase, walked me in, walked me as far as he could through. He stood with me in the security line until they wouldn't let him go any further. He talked to me about all my hobbies and everything to keep me calm. And
that's nice.
And he, like, stood there on the other end of security.
That is the most, like, anxiety part is getting. It's, like, literally, like, the moment you step out of your car until you're through the security check. Like,
that's where you'll get lost or something.
That is, like, the. That is the stressful part. That,
yeah. And he was so, so really nice. Like, on the way there, he was coaching me. He's like, they're going to ask you to take off your shoes. They might ask for a photo ID. Have this. Like, he walked me through every step of it to reduce my anxiety. And then he waited on the other side of security until I got all the way through security. And then he waved to me and he was like, love you. Have fun. And I was like, I love you too.
That's nice.
And then I turned around and the terminal I needed was literally right there. And I was like, oh, great.
It's always kind of like, where am I supposed to go now?
I was like, okay, I'm all set. So he helped a lot with that, and I kind of feel just better about everything. And it's like, I've done it once, I can do it again. And the gala went great. My dress worked out super well. I cannot believe I pulled off that, making that dress on that short of a notice, but it worked. So all in all my yammering to say, great trip, 100%. I want to do it again.
Yeah.
And might get to do it again. And I'm really excited about that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So
cool.
Yeah. It was just very chaotic. There was, like, not a second when we weren't just, like, go, 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 go.
That's how work trips are. They're just, like, constant. Yeah. It's like, can you please, I just want to sit down.
I know. Ugh. And it was, like, in the best of ways. But also,
I know. It's like, you're having a good time. Like, you're not doing anything you don't want to be doing.
I know.
But it's also, like, I need 20 minutes to, like, chill out a little bit. Please.
I know. I literally, like, I was doing the Holocaust Museum, and I literally, like, get all the way through. I was like, ooh, okay. Spent a moment in the reflection room. It was really nice. I lit one of the candles and everything. And then I looked at my phone and I was like, oh no. And I like had to sprint to the African American.
I know, you like can't even like just take a moment to breathe.
You can't.
Yeah.
I like built it in one night. The hotel was like so unbelievably nice. So nice that the bathtub was separate from the shower and nicer than any bathtub I've seen in my entire life. So I did use the bathtub. Sorry, that was really bad in the mic. I did use the bathtub. So there was one night when I was like, no, we get back to the hotel, I'm not doing anything. I'm reserving this as a bathtub night. And it was so nice.
As you should. As you should. I mean, like, you would have left and regretted not doing that.
Oh, I know. I like, there was a TV built into the mirror.
Oh.
I've never seen that. It was like the mirror, it was reflective.
Yeah, I've seen that.
I've never seen that before. Yeah. And so I was like sitting there in the bathtub with the TV on watching the news feeling so bougie.
You were watching the news? Jesus Christ.
Well, I turned on the History Channel eventually.
Oh my God.
It was fitting. Anyways.
What, you watch like Ancient Aliens? Yeah. Oh yes, my day with the History Channel at the Smithsonian's.
It was so fun. So... yeah.
That's awesome. I'm happy for you.
Learned a lot. I'm really excited about my new job and I'm just ready to get started on this cool part of my life. My independent era, if you will.
You just like have a job and like are living alone?
Yes.
You've done both of those things before.
I know, but I haven't felt good about it yet.
Fair enough.
I haven't had a Taylor Swift vibe to it.
Oh, don't.
I'm not saying I'm a Taylor Swift fan. I just think every era, like villain era, reputation era, whatever, I don't know what they are. I just feel like this is my independence era.
I thought you meant that, like, somehow you being, like, a single woman is makes you Taylor Swift. I was like, what? You, what?
No, I will never, no matter how like, hard I try, I
listen,
could
I know that her fans credit her with a lot, but I do think that she did not originate independence. The single womanhood thing. In fact, the opposite of that, with how many guys she's dated.
I think we would attribute that one to, like, someone in Athens. Maybe Sapphos.
Also notoriously not a strong single woman.
Yeah, that's actually true. I just said the first one that came to mind. It was not a great example.
Maybe like Athena. Let's use our big brain.
Artemis is the one that's...
sprung from the brain.
Oh, the brain. Thank you. Athena, thank you.
I think is Athena.
Yeah, no. Athena's sprung from the brain. I was thinking, which one is the one that has like... She's the patron of female hunters or something.
Well, that's Artemis too. Okay. She would also work. Because she's, like, also, like, she's sworn to never marry or to never take,
okay,
like,
that's
a
what
man
I thought. Yeah, okay.
Like
okay.
I think Athena...
She's just cooler. No offense, Artemis.
Why are we pitting women against women?
I don't know. That's on me. That's the patriarchy shining through right
it
there.
It was.
That was.
There is room for Artemis and Athena.
There is. Come on, Kat. You're right.
Oh, man.
But, yes, tweet at us and let us know who your favorite female Greek
no,
guys are.
No, don't do that. You're going to get smote.
Don't actually pit each other. Now, if you want to compete for which male gods.
I was
going to
say, you can fight over which man.
Dionysus
is
the correct answer.
Listen, he's in a league of his own, all right? If we want to do, like, big three, out of the big three, men.
It's not Zeus.
It's not Zeus. Not
it's
Zeus.
It's not Travis. That's stupid meme. Anyway.
It's got to be Poseidon. I mean, like, come on. Who doesn't love a good Poseidon? We all read Percy Jackson.
We did. So. I think that altered our brain chemistry and the way we think about the Greek gods. But, yes.
I mean, yeah, as it should have. I'm not mad about that one.
Well, either way, I'm ready to jump into
Yes, let's do that.
Hold on, let me first get my mouth back together. Okay, let's try that again now that I can speak again.
I knew what you meant. That's the important part.
Yeah, that's true, but they have to know what I mean.
I'm like, I'm the only one who has to sit here and listen to you.
That's true.
Everyone else doesn't have to.
Well, and if you want to skip, I'll give you the quick summary of mine. As I said before, I'll be talking today about the invention of dynamite and Alfred Nobel. So if you're not interested in that, I know that doesn't sound terribly exciting, but it actually is pretty interesting.
I mean,
so
it's dynamite.
It's explosive.
Dynamite.
Yeah, that.
Do you know what that's from?
No. What's it from?
You've never seen Hoodwinked?
Oh, I have. It's just been like well over a decade.
Oh, it's such a good movie. Oh, it's got the worst animation you could ever imagine.
That's all I remember
about
it.
But the movie is so, it's such a good movie. If it was just animated better, it would be literally like top tier movie.
And it cannot be worse than some of the Barbie movies.
It's actually about the same as some of the Barbie movies.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well.
There's I don't that. Care. I'll watch it. Bad animation at all. It's
oh, no.
too iconic
I'm not,
not to watch.
It. I still watch Barbie movies.
It's just like very early days CGI with like a low budget, not even high budget CGI.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, I now know where that is from. So yes. Quick summary. Dude invents a big boom and makes big impact on world.
Okay.
So there we go.
Why say more word when less word do trick?
Exactly. Yes. So the origins of like explosives, if we're really going to get down into the nitty gritty.
I do know what that's from.
Nacho Libre. For those of you who don't know, that is Nacho Libre. The first real explosives are commonly attributed to things like fireworks and gunpowder, which originate in China. As far as we can tell, that's the earliest use of a controlled or intentional explosion. Not saying that people haven't been blowing stuff up and accidentally setting them on fire for far longer than that. The European inventions and use and utilization really starts to show up I think Western culture got a hold of it really around the 14th century. Things like gunpowder start to... It's one of those things, like, it's documented pretty early in the 14th century, but it wasn't really harnessed effectively till a little bit later. So it's hard to, you know, say, this is when we started using black powder or explosives. Yeah. But as research and experimentation happens over the next few centuries, the most common way to create an explosion is by combining anything organic with some form of nitric acid. And that's going to be the foundation for all the big booms and eventually lead to the development of dynamite itself. Mm-hmm. So the inventor Alfred Nobel is not a stranger to innovation by any stretch of the imagination. His father was a Swedish inventor and entrepreneur. He had relocated his family when Alfred was a small child to St. Petersburg in Russia. This is in the 1800s. And explosives are his dad's kind of area of research, for lack of a better term. He collaborated with the Russian military, and he was working on mines in the sea. Mm-hmm. And what explosives and best demolition, you know, methods could be used there. But because of this, Alfred and his siblings had a pretty good access to education above what a normal household, like working household, would have in Russia in the 1800s. He was taught mostly by prominent Swedish and Russian academics who also had a background. I mean, his dad had these connections. His dad saw the value of education, obviously. And Alfred himself was interested in a myriad of things, not just the sciences, but showed a proclivity for the liberal arts as well. Out of the sciences, though, chemistry was kind of a fish-to-water situation. He really had a knack for it, and his father was pretty pushy, apparently, in how he encouraged his son to pursue chemistry and the sciences rather than, you know, rhetoric or writing or being an author, which
let your kids do what they want.
I know, honestly. And I got the impression from what I was reading that Alfred didn't mind chemistry. He knew he was good at it. He enjoyed it. It just, he wanted,
it wasn't kind like of the a option. Passion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even then, I mean,
like, I get that. There's stuff that I'm good at that I'm like, eh, I don't, like, right. I know that I'm good at that, but that's not, like, what I want to do with my life.
Right. Well, and it's kind of a shame because I feel like now in academics, there's more of a market for combining those two things. Like, you could be a very accomplished chemist who uses their skills as an author to write articles, to write books, to, right. you know, be a public, like, figure on a topic or something like that. But mm-hmm. back then...
Give a TED Talk. It's
not really as
TED interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But... His father does continue encouraging him to pursue chemistry more so than liberal arts by giving him money and kind of like helping him travel to study specifically things like chemistry. Mm-hmm. You know, what brave scientist has not done the European tour, of course, for their studies?
What young man of means has not mm-hmm. gone abroad and discovered himself for
Henry
6 months?
Man in, with a, what is it? In want of a fortune, is in need of a wife, or I cannot remember the opening line to Pride and Prejudice.
What is it?
A truth universally acknowledged that
that any man
in possession of good wealth is in want of a wife.
Want of a wife, hold
something
on.
Like that.
I'll look it up.
I was about to say we can't do Jane Austen dirty. Not here, not now.
No, Jane, I'm so sorry, girl. Have you seen that TikTok? That's like the like wasn't gonna drink tonight, but I'm missing Jane Austen a little.
Yes,
extra.
I see that. That's a good one.
Is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
Okay. Bam. Yeah, I need a little help to get through that first part, but yes, it is a truth universally acknowledged.
It's like
that
you got the gist of it. It's just the specific wording. Yeah.
So our truth to be universally acknowledged is that a man whose father wants him to pursue science and STEM rather than the liberal arts will be given money and a tour of Europe. Actually, that's very fitting for this day and age. That sounds like something a rich STEM bro would do.
Yeah.
But regardless, his father sends him around Europe to different laboratories and science centers and stuff to study. During his travels, one of the most impactful and important connections that he would make is when he's at a laboratory and introduced to Ascanio. It's Italian, so I'm afraid I'm gonna mispronounce this. Ascanio or Ascanio Sobrero. an Italian chemist who had made a name for himself already by messing around and introducing a form of nitroglycerin in the middle of the 1800s. I think somewhere around 1847. Basically, this chemist had been treating glycerol with sulfuric acid and nitric acid. And this mixture creates a reaction, an exothermic one, that essentially results in so much heat so quickly that it causes an explosion unless it's cooled while the reaction is happening. Mm. They're doing these experiments and developments, though, in areas that, like physical areas, in spaces and labs that, by our standards, are nowhere near clean and sterile or stable.
Mm-hmm.
We understand a lot more about lab safety, about how compounds work, about the dire circumstances should something go wrong. And this mixture that Mr. Sobrero had created was extremely temperamental, to say the least. Often the mixture was, by our standards, impure, kind of mm-hmm. corrupted by other chemicals and in measuring and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So even though he had created nitroglycerin, he didn't have a way to keep it stable. It was prepared, essentially. It was a chemical that was ready to explode at any given moment, or if it was used the wrong way or touched or jolted or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it exists, and Nobel sees this and has firsthand experience talking to the person who invented it and understands the workings of it. But as he continues his research in chemistry, rather than at this point, he's pretty much given up on the liberal arts, I think. Mm-hmm. His father kind of won out and got him to stick to chemistry exclusively. And so he studies with a lot more notable names before returning home to St. Petersburg. Sorry, my nose is itching. The family business itself had been doing pretty dang well up to that point. They had a factory that was supplying basically imperative materials to the Crimean War. So, you know, it's like America during the World Wars. What pulls a country out of debt better than a war? So this family was really benefiting from that war. And you know what happens when the war ends? And that business goes away. Financial hardship.
Mm-hmm.
The family is struggling after the war. They'd seen those boom years. They'd gotten used to, I don't know if they'd gotten used to a certain lifestyle and were living lavishly, or if after the war there was just zero need for it anymore and there was no income. Or maybe they'd hired help to keep up with the need, and then when there was no need, they couldn't hold it together.
Yeah.
But either way, the family business goes bankrupt. But father and son are a duo now, along with some of the other siblings, and Alfred and his dad decide to focus instead on producing nitroglycerin for construction purposes. That way they can sell it en masse to people who... Because what's the one thing that we never stop doing? Never stop building stuff, like mm-hmm. physically structures. There's always a building that needs either improvement or to be leveled so that you can build a new one. And especially after wartime, you got to clear rubble, you got to build things. So it's a good industry for them to jump into. And it's not the most commonly produced material at this time. It was kind of unstable, so not a ton of people were doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Alfred is very young at this point that he kind of creates this duo agreement with him and his dad to start producing nitroglycerin. He was probably in his late teens to early 20s during this venture.
Wow.
Yeah. Still pretty young. Maybe in his early 20s at this point. But this is... There's a good reason that not a ton of people were doing this. It is dangerous. And it had a personal cost to him, too. When they start producing nitroglycerin, they get a manufacturing kind of plant outside of Stockholm. And it's just for producing nitroglycerin, but there is an explosion. And the youngest Nobel sibling, Emil, is killed, along with a few of the other workers in the factory at the time. And it reiterates not just the danger. I was reading one article that said it was such a dangerous, unstable thing to work with these chemicals that they would have the people working with them sitting on essentially a one-legged stool so that you had to hold yourself up at all times to be balanced.
Mm.
So that if you started to nod off or not pay attention, you couldn't, it would jolt you awake. And yeah. I was like, well, if you're working people so hard that they're falling asleep,
maybe don't
in front of massively dangerous chemicals, maybe you're doing something wrong.
Maybe don't give them the chemicals to work with.
Yeah, but also Industrial Revolution, you're going to work everyone to the bone. Well, I guess we're not quite in the Industrial Revolution yet, but we're gearing up towards it. It's that time. After his younger brother Emil dies, they try to make adjustments, you know, without safety laws in place or OSHA or anything like that. They do what they can within their limitations. They kind of move the factory to a more isolated place where less people would be in harm's way if something were to happen. But it's just a dangerous compound to be working with, regardless of how far you are from a city or the precautions you take. So this further spurs Nobel to develop a safer version of nitroglycerin. He wants to create something that's less likely to be corrupted or explode or be unstable. And let's be clear, even if it's not like what we picture Industrial Revolution in like America, the Industrial Revolution does span a long period. Mm-hmm. And I've seen debated like conversations about when the Industrial Revolution really starts. When does the ideology of it start versus mm-hmm. when does the technology start and everything. But if you were to consider this the Industrial Revolution, think about like how many massive changes there are in the workforce. They needed to understand chemicals better. They need to understand mm-hmm. Gases better than ever, especially in like mining industries and in close proximity places where there's so much soot and coal. Like they're desperate to start learning the science behind this stuff a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
Factories that utilize gas, heat, and explosives are looking for the information. It takes someone totally different, like Nobel, to find a way to harness it safely.
Mm-hmm.
So after testing around with different theories, he realizes that putting a blasting cap on the explosive itself is going to help control the reaction, that it could be stabilized a little bit by adding siliceous earth as well. It's like a kind of gravel aggregate, like think like dirt.
Yeah, I know what that is.
Okay, yeah.
What'd you call it?
I can never pronounce it right.
I need to see the word, but...
Oh, I'll pull it up for you. I don't have the word written down in my notes.
It's not salacious.
I know. I said it. I know salacious is a different thing, because salacious is...
I need to
is,
see the word, but it's...
I know. Salacious is like a salacious detail.
Yeah.
Hold on. It's S-I-L... I can never pronounce this. It's... silica soil.
Well, now silicious. I'm nervous.
Hold on. We can get pronounce.
Hey, we have a podcast, so it's all about auditory.
It just brought up how to pronounce dirt.
Dirt.
Hold on. Okay. Salacious. It's the same word.
You're giving it
not
an A.
I know. It's salacious an I is like the dirty details.
Yeah.
I know. But
salacious.
That dirt.
Yeah. Salacious. It's that, like salacious without yes, the A sound.
It's just weird. It's like trying to say alcohol.
You could do that one.
Apparently not. I get made fun of it for a lot when I say alcohol.
Only when you say it fast.
Anyways, Kat's inability to pronounce things aside, yes, that salicious.
There you go. That was
there we go.
Beautiful.
Thank you. That salicious earth could be used to stabilize nitroglycerin. And that stabilization makes it easier to handle, to put into the blasting cap, and it creates a controlled explosion we now know as dynamite.
Dynamite.
So essentially, this blasting cap is this, it's an ignition point. So black gun, it's like, not black gunpowder, sorry. It could be black gunpowder, I guess. It's your explosive material itself. Mm-hmm. A little bit of it is shoved into the wooden cap, which could be connected to a fuse. And when ignited, that small explosion triggers the nitroglycerin around it, creating that exothermic huge explosion.
Okay.
So it's like mini explosion leads to boom. And his inventions didn't stop here. But this does, this dynamite is what he becomes kind of known for, what skyrockets his family's business back to its prominence. They sell some of their patents to dynamite, all the accompanying related forms of explosives. They sell to multiple companies. They make a business out of it. It's lucrative, to say the least, and amasses them quite the fortune if you think about how much dynamite, how many patents there are on it, how many explosives? If every explosive was attributed to one person, this is a pretty good chunk of change.
And then Tayo Cruz writes a song about it.
Damn it. Anyways.
We gonna go all night. We gonna light it up.
Like it's dynamite. Dang it. I hate that I remember that. That was iconic for 2008. I'm guessing it was 2008.
If it's not 2008, it's got 2008 vibes.
It does.
And that's all true. That matters.
Mm-hmm. So Alfred Nobel doesn't stop there necessarily. He continues working on blasting materials, explosives, et cetera, used from everything to construction to, unfortunately, some more malicious causes. His focus seemed to be stabilizing the explosives for construction purposes. I do want to make that clear. The stabilized version that he created with the soil was almost more malleable, so it could be manipulated into shapes for dynamite. It could be, you know, fit into brick or something like that if you needed to explode something. Is that grammar? To explode something? You can explode something.
You can explode something. Yeah.
Yeah, it just felt weird when I said it.
I think so. I'll allow it, at least.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it. So over the course of his life, he had like something like 335 inventions or patents and developments.
Wow.
He was very, very effective and very not lucrative. What is it when you produce a lot of stuff?
Prolific.
Prolific, thank you. And towards the end of his life, he got really sick. Apparently his brother was on a vacation and passed away, and a journalist got mixed up which brother was which and printed something about how Alfred Nobel was dead.
Hmm.
The article itself heralded him as the person who, quote, became rich by finding a way to kill more people faster than ever before.
Hmm.
Because at this point, even though he died, I wrote it down somewhere. I believe 1896. Mm-hmm. He hadn't seen the World War yet.
Yeah.
He died before that. But he definitely saw what his inventions were being used for. And that was very difficult for him. He did note multiple times that ethically, he was very troubled by... Like his 1887 powders and explosives being used in military projectiles and intentionally cruel ways to hurt people, especially when he himself had done all of that effort to stabilize nitroglycerin because he wanted it to make it safer for people to handle because he had lost his brother to it.
Right.
And when he died in 1896, he knew, like, my product can be used for good and evil, but to die... having read an article, your own obituary, essentially.
Right.
Heralding you as, like, the purveyor of death.
Yeah.
Was really, really hard for him, apparently. And I can understand why. But it's so weird to me because he knew the possibilities of what he developed, what could be done with it. But he never saw the magnitude of what would be done with it.
Yeah.
He didn't see, and I'm not saying like, oh, he's directly responsible for everything that happened in World War I and World War II, but his developments and research in explosives and stabilizing it allowed this industry, this field to really, for the first time, blossom into what it would be.
Right.
And so I told Kaylee that my topic's a little different today because I'm not just talking about Alfred Nobel, but I wanted to give the background history of dynamite there. So that we could actually change our format a little bit. Because I want to postulate what would have happened if we didn't have dynamite? Or if it had been developed differently, or if it hadn't been stabilized? Because if you think about it, dynamite is one of the most influential things ever created.
Because, like, essentially it's like the first bomb, right?
It's the first bomb, but yeah. I mean, the only reason we have railroads
right.
is because of dynamite.
Right.
And Manifest Destiny wouldn't have been possible. Like, we wouldn't have, like, created America, but then again, the entire yeah. indigenous people might not have been wiped out.
Right.
When it comes to mining, we would never have gotten access to coal and resources without dynamite. But then again, since then, we've stripped the earth of its materials because of our right. access to mining. With bombs, we couldn't defend ourselves without the origins of dynamite and explosives. Mm-hmm. But we also could have prevented a lot of really terrible attacks. Like,
yeah.
I wanted to almost bring this to the table to talk about a little bit, because
yeah.
this is an ethical question that he died not having the answer to.
Yeah.
And where do you think we would be if we'd never touched
so, it? As with most things like this, I think that if he hadn't have invented it, someone else would. Because he didn't invent the nitroglyceride bomb.
Right.
He perfected it and made it
mm-hmm.
usable.
Mm-hmm.
And someone else would have, because okay. there's potential there.
Good point.
So that's always my caveat with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we really want to ask this question, what if... Because the Chinese people were just using gunpowder for fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what if they had never realized, or I think it was, like, Europeans who saw it and were like, that's...
Oh, that's big boom?
That, we can use that. Like, what if that had never happened, mm-hmm. you know? What if we were still knives and swords
right.
and
right.
catapults and...
Yeah.
Throwing bodies over walls for biowarfare.
Yeah, well,
you know,
and it makes me wonder, like, and this is the whole problem with the conversation about butterfly effect, is mm-hmm. because, okay, maybe he didn't invent it, but maybe someone else would have invented it, and it would have taken another 50 years. And
well, it would have looked differently. It for yeah, sure would have. Yeah.
And would it have been worse or better? Because if right. no one had invented dynamite, by the time we get to World War One, they wouldn't have had quite the materials to develop bombs the way we right. did. And
yeah.
things like in World War II, like carpet bombing
yeah.
are or, horrendous.
You know, like, you could take it the other way with that same vein of thought. Like, what if someone else invented it, but it wasn't as effective at all?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
What if it was more dangerous?
What if it wasn't worth the risk to your military?
To produce and
to produce
carry
and
it.
Carry it and do all and employ it in their warfare.
Yeah.
What if then?
And what if we hadn't developed it by the time, like, who knows? Maybe military leaders wouldn't have been so brazen with each other, and trench warfare would have been
yeah.
entirely different. What if we hadn't started using trench warfare? And how much
right.
was trench warfare encouraged by explosives? You
right.
know, versus, like, it would radically change the definition of
mm-hmm.
war, and that's for sure. But on the expansion front, that's what really gave me pause.
Yeah.
Is railroads.
Yeah. So I think with that, again, it's not a matter of how, it's a matter of when.
Okay.
Like, something like dynamite definitely made things happen faster.
Mm-hmm.
But I do still think that they would have figured out a way
mm-hmm.
to have the railroads connect. It would have meant that we would have stayed separate. Like, the United States would not have been as kind of one piece as, like, quickly as it did.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe we would have more significant and specific cultures when you go from West Coast to East Coast.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because they were allowed to develop longer
would
on their
we,
own.
Would we have had one cohesive America? Or would we have East and West? Because
right.
railroads had central growth from either side of our coasts.
Mm-hmm.
Who's to say they wouldn't have run into each other in the middle and been competitive over their land and said, okay, the East is ours, the West is yours.
It's true.
Like,
hey. I mean, there's a lot of... This is the what-if game with history can...
It really gets you, but I was like,
well,
this...
no, I mean, you can, there's so many things you can talk about because
yeah.
there's so many different layers to, well, if it did happen, what mm-hmm. if he had put on his dynamite patent, hey, you can't use this if it's for war, only for building.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
that's
I
true.
Will not, militaries are not allowed to use my patent. Militaries would still probably have hired someone
to develop,
to
their,
develop
own
their own version.
Yeah.
Would that have been as effective?
Right. Well, and I would love to talk to an epidemiologist and ask them, like, hey, if railroads didn't have dynamite and we to build them and they had to go around mountains or over mountains, I'm assuming that America, my guess is, probably would have relied more heavily on slave labor or extremely
They would have
manipulative labor to do it, to do that backbreaking work.
They probably would have, it wouldn't have been a less of a, we're going through this mountain. It's how can we develop technology to
go over,
get around it,
get around it. Yeah.
Around, up, over, however they figure it out. Maybe.
Yeah.
You and know, they focus on that instead of, we can just plow through.
Right. Right.
And then we would have Big John, Big Bad John.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was literally thinking about that the other day, about the ballad of
Big John. Big John.
Oh, we had a different name for him. Ah, I cannot think of his name.
What is your name for him? It's literally got a song.
I'll think of it later. It's like it's the same thing. I know exactly what you're talking about. I would have loved to talk to an epidemiologist and ask and talk to them about what they think would have happened if railroad and like Manifest Destiny expansion would have been slower, and what that would have been done to Indigenous people.
Right.
Would there have been more time between the covered wagons arriving to build immunity to these diseases? And then when the big waves of colonizers that were spurred by railroads, would it maybe have not wiped them out as much? Or like, what would it have done to the Indigenous population if we hadn't been able to colonize so quickly through the railroads? Like, there's...
Would it have even have made a difference?
You know? Like... Yeah. Would we have gotten the same place anytime anyway? Mm-hmm. And also the people in the world that are born. Like, what if we hadn't developed as effective bombings and military systems before, say, Hitler rose to power?
Right.
Like, what if he didn't have the military capability to
Or what if he was
do this?
The first one to have that military capability?
And would the world have been able to stop him if he had?
And that's the thing.
It could have been worse.
And again,
but it could be better.
Yeah. That's why when you do the what if game with history, there's so many different ways you could take it.
Yeah. It can always be better. It could always be worse. Mm-hmm. Which is terrible when you look
at... Because if Hitler is the one to develop the bomb, and no one's ever had to deal with bombs before, oh my God.
Well, and this would have radically altered how we see research into bombing. So what if people like Oppenheimer didn't have a field to work in? What if there were people, the only people doing it were in Germany? What if Germany had got a hold of that? Like, there's so... many, but that's why I wanted to bring this to the table, because dynamite, I think, I did not realize how much it affects the foundational growth of the world to have access to
a
stable explosive.
That's a good point.
So I kind of want to know, like, what other people, like, what you would think of a world, or what weird thing you can think of that's been helped by dynamite or altered by dynamite, and what you think it could be. I genuinely never would have thought, oh, railroads. When I think about I would have thought of military.
That's actually, like, the first thing I think.
I would have thought of military. Explosions.
And I think, honestly, it's probably because of that movie, Hoodwinked. Because the whole... I don't know if you remember, but they're, like, going through, like, train tracks. And the little squirrel guy finds, like, somehow he ends up with a stick of dynamite. And he reads it. He's like, ooh, dinamite. And they're like, what did you say? And they're like, oh, no. So, like, throw it. Oh, man, that's such a good movie. It's not on any streaming thing, but I watched, like, a recap of it on YouTube. I forgot how good of a movie that was. Anyway. Well, and then I think, like, you know, the development of the West is a little bit more of my historic interest than you with war.
That's fair, yeah.
So it's, you know, just kind of, like, where your mind goes when you think of these kinds of things.
That's, yeah, that's very valid. It's, yeah, what is most prominent, yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, it's, you know.
Yeah. It's something you can sit and talk about and postulate all day. I did just kind of want to bring that for conversation for a minute.
No, I think it's always fun to, even if like the what if game in history is kind of like pointless because what happened happened and there's nothing we can do about that.
Right.
It's still a good practice to sit down and think, how much has this one seemingly innocuous development actually affected?
Well,
yeah,
and that's the big change, I think, between like high school history and college history and historians and people who like history. There's a difference between memorizing the facts and then understanding them and talking about them and analyzing them,
and how something as small as, you know, Yeah, hey, I think I want to help my dad out and make my family a little money can lead to atom bombs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so, yeah. I do want to note, though, that in a way, Nobel, I mean, he'll always be the inventor of dynamite, but he won't always necessarily be remembered for dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
Because his name is most synonymous now with the Nobel Peace Prize.
Okay, I was like, is it that guy?
It is.
Okay, or is it just another guy named Nobel?
Well, no, it is. And I think he would have been very happy about rather being associated with the Nobel Peace Prize than the invention of dynamite.
Yeah.
It's because, well, when he died, he left his wealth and resources to an endowment, actually, purposefully created to provide awards in medicine, literature, physics, chemistry, and peace efforts.
Good for him.
To be awarded to people most dedicated to those fields.
I do feel bad for him, because he probably had no way of knowing that this is what he was doing. There's people like Oppenheimer who knew exactly what this meant.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and even if they didn't understand the magnitude of it, they understood what they were doing. And, well, and Oppenheimer too talked about how hard that was ethically. Yeah. He was like,
"Yeah,
I was just doing a job,
right?
You know, like I didn't want to kill
the Nazi
people.
Defense."
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's the hard thing. It's like Nobel could have known, oh, this could be misused, but would he ever know the magnitude? Like,
would he have even conceived of the invention of the hydrogen bomb?
Right.
You know, like,
and how far physics would come in the next century.
Like, he had no way of knowing that, because
this is within the century.
Yeah, it was.
We go from the invention of dynamite in stabilized form to the
nuclear weapons.
Yeah and that's crazy.
Yeah, which is like, again, I don't blame him as much as I blame some of his predecessors, because not predecessors, the other one, people who came after him.
Posterity.
Successors. Because, like, he is kind of, like, again, I don't think he fully understood what exactly he was doing, and I have sympathy for that.
And in a way, he just took the nitroglycerin that already existed and stabilized.
Yeah, that's, he had no
he
idea.
He was trying to make it safer.
He didn't invent it. He was trying to kill less people.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can call him naive, and he probably was, but, like, it's not like he went out to create a weapon of mass destruction.
I know. And that's, and that's what's so interesting about the conversation, too, around war and weapons. Like, there are always going to be ways to misuse things and inventions, and that's really unfortunate. And there is no way to even know that the measures you are taking, whether it's to save someone's life or hurt someone, what it's going to be used for.
Yeah. No, and that's, like, something that you, as someone who's creating something, should always be aware of. You know, it's the don't caught up if.
Right.
Like, you just being like, I want to do this because I want to do it, and I want to prove that I can do it. You need to, like, take a step back and be like, how will this affect society?
Right.
Like,
well, and at its root, if I say, oh, I'm going to stabilize nitroglycerin so people don't lie to my brother, how will this affect society? Good. Mm-hmm. The answer should be good.
Yeah.
It should be a good thing for
society. It should be, like, you should always have that. If you're going to invent something, maybe think further than, I only care if I can actually do it. Maybe think of, like,
imagine what if the worst
will this
person
have
in
any
world...
lasting consequences?
And ask yourself, if the worst person in the world gets a hold of it, what's the worst that can happen?
Exactly.
Which unfortunately, like, is pretty bad every way you slice it.
I forget if it's, like, AI or... It's, like, one of the people who, like, started the big technology that's, like, screwing with everything right now.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, I wish I never did this. It's like, well, I wish you would have thought of that.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of lot of inventors, and especially in the digital
age, world,
who have been like, this was never what it was supposed to be.
Maybe you should have thought of that.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes you can't conceive of how far humanity.
Well, and I'm not blaming anyone for that. Like, that's, I'm not going to hold
but
anyone against that.
That's the scary thing about human nature.
Yeah.
You cannot predict humans.
But it's, again, the question should be, I'm inventing this technology.
Mm-hmm.
You put it very well just now. If the worst person in the world gets a hold of it, what will it do for them?
Yeah.
And if it's going to benefit them, then maybe
maybe not.
Maybe not. Or at least try to put in as many safeguards as you can to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, because if we did everything in fear.
Right.
And we would never.
And I'm not saying that.
But you're
like,
right. That was an important stipulation you just made, that always do it with as many safeguards as possible.
Mm-hmm. And you're never going to get everything. There's always going to be a loophole that someone with enough money to pay lawyers will
find. To buy your patent from you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But like, it's your moral duty. I feel like, as a person who lives in the society, to make sure that what you were inventing does not hurt someone.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it, yeah.
Especially in this day and age when we have seen time and time again the consequences of that not happening.
That's true. We have more precedent.
I don't
now
blame
than ever.
The dynamite guy, Nobel, because he had no idea.
Right.
Like, we're talking Industrial Revolution. No one knew back then. They didn't know what the fuck they were doing.
No.
They were just like, ooh, factories.
Child labor.
Child labor. That has no lasting consequences. Send the children to the mines.
In the year 2018, the children yearn for the mines.
100 years later, Minecraft. But you know what I mean. Like, you know, I don't blame the earliest people per se because, like,
how could they conceive
how
of...
How could they?
You cannot tell me in any faith that Alfred Nobel had a concept of what, you know, the H-bomb or A-bomb would look like.
And to a certain extent, too, I don't blame the people who did stuff on early internet.
Right.
Because it's kind of the same... Because
who knew humanity would create this?
Who the hell knew this was going to be what it was?
This wasn't physically possible.
Yeah. What is the internet?
You can't conceive of something that has
that?
Literally never existed.
Wi-Fi?
Yeah.
What is that?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have no idea. So, like...
Yeah.
I don't necessarily blame the pioneers, but I do still think that, you know...
It's the people that manipulate it.
Yeah. You still have your duty
mm-hmm.
to take a step back and don't get caught up in your own ego and your own, like, hubris.
Mm-hmm.
And be like, hey, I'm really wrapped up in the question of can I do this, but I need to be asking if I should. And I don't know, I'm not an inventor. So, I don't know.
I know.
You know.
And that's the weird thing. And
it's really easy for me to say.
Well, history is full of stuff like that, that it spurs this conversation. And it should. Again, this is what history is really for, to learn from and talk about and everything. So,
Well, that was really good. I appreciated learning that.
Thank you. I kind of thought it was one of those things where I was like, it's important to know who Alfred Nobel was.
Yeah, I
and important
think
to
so.
Know what dynamite is, but it's more important to also think about
understand.
The consequences of it in history. And I think that's something we talk about a lot on this podcast. It's like, what are the consequences of this moment in history?
Yeah, for sure.
Because it's not just a chronology to get to this point; it's everything after that too.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Recommendations?
Yeah, let's do it. I had one and then I forgot it.
I also just came up with one just like 2 minutes ago. Like,
go
not even 30 minutes.
Go
but
for it.
What? No, not even 30 seconds, but I think I just forgot it. My recommendation is to just go Halloween shopping.
I love that.
That's my recommendation. Even if you're not going to buy anything, even if you can't afford to go crazy.
Get yourself in the mood.
Get yourself in the spooky mood. I don't know if you've seen them, but they have like giant Lego minifigure heads that you can use for candy bowls. And I got a set of two. So I have one.
I did wonder.
I have one in here. There is chocolate in here. So if you would like some,
okay,
you're welcome to it.
It doesn't even matter what kind of chocolate. Give me.
Go for it.
Also, I did just... Oh, you got, like, candy in here.
What, do you think I'm a cheap out?
Oh, my God. Okay. This is a Reese's peanut butter cup.
Hell
this
yeah,
is,
it
this
is.
This is good candy. This is not a little Hershey's Kiss. Not
no.
that that isn't good, but this is, like, candy.
No, I'm not going to. I'm not going to fuck around with this, all right?
I'm impressed. I'm very impressed. I did think of, a second ago, John Henry. I didn't know him as Big John. I know him as John Henry.
Oh, yeah. John Henry. Yeah,
yeah,
that's his full name.
I knew I just know him. I didn't know him as Big John, but when you said it, I was like, it has to be John Henry.
Yeah.
But my recommendation is, and this is going to be like a much easier said than done thing, is to, whatever circumstance you are in, to let yourself be happy about it. To let yourself be excited about it. Because there's always going to be like, and that's part of anxiety that I've been fighting for a long time is the what ifs always overshadow the good moments. And I realized I was losing out on a lot of really good moments because I'm scared of what's going to come eventually.
Yeah.
And that's way easier said than done.
Yeah.
You know, some people, you know, you need to talk to a therapist about it or get some medication to help with that process. And that's all fine. But I found while I was on my trip, I was like spending so much time being worried about like, oh, when I get back and the job actually starts and this. And I was like, whatever's going to happen at this point is going to happen.
Yeah.
I bought a ticket for this roller coaster and I'm strapped in. So yeah. I just kind of...
Well, that's kind of what I've been telling you with this job. Like, hey, don't let it cloud your enjoyment.
Yeah.
And I think there's a balance to that because, like, that's a really good point and I completely agree. Mm-hmm. But also, like, don't get totally caught up in that. Yeah. Sometimes things are risky and it's helpful to know the risk, but don't let that consume your experience right. with something.
And I know. And
like, going to the beach has an inherent risk to it,
yes,
you know?
Yes.
But that doesn't mean you still can't have a great day at the beach.
Right. And I was, like, sitting on the plane and I was like, I'm so nervous. Not even about the job necessarily, but I was like, I'm so nervous. I'm flying alone. What if I do something wrong? And I was like, in this moment, in this plane, in this seat, there is nothing you are doing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
When you get there, maybe you get lost in the terminal, but that is for then. And in this moment,
yeah.
you aren't doing anything
wrong. I
think
that's good. I think that's a good idea.
I think I came back from that trip feeling much more independent. And I think that's part of the reason it felt kind of not, I'm not saying I had the most transformative experience of my life, but coming back from it, I suddenly realized I was like, I just feel like I was forced by nature of traveling and doing all that to relinquish a little bit of the panic and control and just let the spaces in between my decisions be enjoyable.
Yeah.
And that's something I definitely, yeah. if you can, you know, practice that mm-hmm. to practice it. Cause now I'm like putting it into practice in other ways in my life. And
you
I was
what's
like,
funny,
this
Kat, is I've been telling you this for like
I know.
Years.
Well, that's the thing.
You just got to let it be.
Well, and that's the thing. It's not even, I don't even process it as letting it be.
Yeah.
I'm just like trying to like remind myself that like, you are safe.
Look,
you are happy in this moment. Yeah. And that's what it is like that.
Don't worry. I'm not offended because I know that you.
It's the way my brain works.
You literally, I can tell you something 50 bajillion times and you will not listen to me until you're like, oh.
Well, it's not even listening. It's like, and I'll hear
No,
people.
I know that you'll hear me, but you won't like.
My brain doesn't process yeah. it until I'm in the moment.
Yeah.
And it takes a big moment sometimes for me to prop my brain yeah. to process those things. And that's just the way my brain works, which sucks sometimes. But
yeah. Well, just know that I'm not going to stop telling you these things.
Right.
I would feel like a bad friend if I could just be like, oh, well, Kat doesn't listen to me anyway. So I'm just going to like no. fuck off and let her figure everything out for herself.
No. And I appreciate it. I do. Because sometimes I just have to hear something a million times before it gets to my head. But and that's why I say I know it is easier said than done than to just, you know, relax, vibe. But like
yeah.
the in-between spaces where there is nothing you can do.
Like this is totally out of my control and I'm yeah, just going to enjoy this just, right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it took me
well,
physically.
Well, it's not even that it's like out of your control. You have done everything you needed to do and you could enjoy the benefit from.
Yeah, that's true.
From doing what you needed to do. Like, think about, like, your example of being in the plane.
Mm-hmm.
You got yourself there on time. You got yourself through security. You got yourself packed. You got yourself... They didn't confiscate your stuff. They didn't
yeah.
check through your bags. You didn't get flagged out. Like, you've done everything. You didn't get tackled by airport security.
No,
like,
I did not.
You had your boarding pass up. Like, you successfully got yourself on the plane.
Yeah.
And that time in the plane, you know, is the time you get to just be like, I
yeah.
did it. I'm here.
I did it. Yeah.
And the next thing I have to worry about is how do I get out of the airport? But that's much less stressful because it's not like you have a time constraint or anything.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So it's kind yeah. of like, it's kind of like that. Like you can kind of rest easy knowing
yeah.
I've done my job
mm-hmm.
and now I get to just chill do out it. And enjoy the benefit of I got myself to the airport properly, which
yeah.
is hard to do.
Sometimes it really is.
Yeah. Like it's not an easy thing to go to the airport.
Yeah.
Even
especially not DFW airport.
Oh god, that place is a nightmare. Oh my god.
But yeah, so that's
yeah.
that's my advice to the best of your ability.
Yeah.
I know, and again, it's rich coming from me, and it took a really big moment for
I
me.
I mean, I don't even think like it's rich coming from you. It might mean more coming from you because if I say it, then people are gonna be like, okay, you don't care about anything, though. Like,
as someone who cares way too much about absolutely everything in my life, I have found that it is possible occasionally to just exist.
Yeah.
And that and let yourself be happy.
Yeah. Well, it's like with your new job, like, you know, there are some inherent risks of taking a job at this specific place.
Mm-hmm.
but that doesn't mean you can't enjoy it in the meantime. That can't, like, there were really good parts for you about your old job.
Yeah.
You know, and you enjoyed a lot of what you did there. Like, ultimately, it ended up being not the place for you, but that's okay. That's part of learning, and that's part of growing, and that's part of living life, is sometimes things like that happen to you. And, like, with this place, like, I hope it doesn't, but I think you would be silly to not remember that it could.
Right,
you
know? Right.
Just, like...
I just gotta remember that they can,
yeah,
not assume that they will.
And that's, yeah, that's what I've kind of been, like, hey, I don't think you need to go into this with, like, a bad attitude and, like, this is gonna happen to me, you know, again, because it happened to me one time. No.
Yeah.
But just be like, hey, this is in the realm of possibility. And I think that, like, if something bad does end up happening to anyone at a job, you're better off being like, hey, this might happen to me, instead of being totally blindsided. Because I think that was a big thing for you, was being totally blindsided by what happened at your last job.
I trusted way too much.
And so, just, like, as your friend, it just makes me, you know, I just want to know that you're going to be okay. So
I think I'm going to be okay at this new job.
Yeah.
Good. I'm different and the job's different. Yeah. But... So, yeah, that's our recommendations, and I'm ready to learn about your topic today, your person today.
Yeah.
Also, so, they were really good. It's a really good Reese's peanut butter cup.
Good. I'm glad. Actually, I've only had a Kit Kat. I haven't had the Reese's yet. I'm glad you enjoy it. You're welcome to one anytime. That's why I have it here on my – I also have one in my office.
So. I love that.
So –
I love it.
No one's probably going to eat it, but I don't care. It's there, and it makes me happy.
Everyone needs something spooky in their office space.
Okay, so just for warning, this is a bio that's really, really short. This woman lived a very long life, and it seemed like she had, like, a very adventurous life, but unfortunately it was not documented really well. So I do think she deserves a whole episode just devoted to her, but it might not be as long as some of the other bios.
Okay.
Which is weird when that happens, because, like, you can tell that this person was obviously, like, pretty influential, but where is it? Where's the information?
Right. It's like Googling someone that everyone talks about in the wiki article is, like, a paragraph, and you're like, hello? I know, you're like,
okay. So I'm going to be talking today about Chavela Vargas. She is a Mexican, well, she's actually from Costa Rica, but she spent most of her time in Mexico, singer, and she was incredibly influential in the like, kind of development of modern Hispanic and Mexican music
to this day.
So her full name is Maria Isabel Anita Carmen de Jesus Cavella Vargas Lizano.
Okay, nice.
So apparently Cavella or Chavela, I think I heard it both ways, is a nickname for Isabel. So that's what she would eventually become, like, most known for, especially in her career. She was born on April 17th in 1919 in San Joaquin de Flores in Costa Rica. She is the daughter of Francisco Vargas and Herminia Lizano. And she was baptized with her full name, Maria Isabel Anita Carmen de Jesus Vargas Lizano.
Okay.
On July 15th, 1919. So that's why she has so many names, because it's like a baptism thing.
Okay.
She had a pretty not great childhood. Her parents, like, first of all, she got, like, polio. Not good, ever. Her parents also divorced and, like, just completely abandoned her and left her under the care of her aunt and uncle.
Oh, boy.
Unfortunately for her, too, growing up, she always had a proclivity for more masculine things than she was stereotypically, like, expected to do.
Mm-hmm.
So she, like, more masculine hobbies and pursuits, and then also she preferred to dress more masculinely, to the point where she was bullied for it, and her aunt and uncle would even hide her away from any guests that would visit their house.
Whoa.
Yeah, because they were ashamed of her and her, like, wanting to dress more masculine. So, understandably, when she was 17, she leaves Costa Rica altogether, and she goes to Mexico, specifically Mexico City, in the hopes of pursuing a music career. and she kind of starts, like, she has no money, no connections, no nothing. And she picks up a series of odd jobs and starts, like, singing wherever she can. In the streets, in bars, anywhere she can. She's trying to, like, make a name for herself. Her specialty were rancheras, which is traditional Mexican music. This is a quote from Carlos Gutierrez, who I pulled from an interview that he did about her from NPR, but he says, quote, "Ranchero music was for many, many years male-dominated. She took ranchero music and made the music her own. She stripped the music from the trumpet and other arrangements. The combination between the guitars and her song just elevate the music to a whole nother level." Hmm. So she took this very, like, traditional music that had been sung in one way and kind of one way only and really made it her own. And this is kind of what made her famous, is she was, like, singing these songs in ways. And again, these are, like, traditional songs, so people know them, like, right, very well.
It's almost harder. It's like covering a song. It's almost harder to do a cover
and, like, make it your own. Everyone
knows what the original sounds like.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of, it reminds me of, like, Luke Combs covering Fast Car, you know, like.
I didn't know that he did that.
Yeah. So apparently Tracy Chapman, like, is, like, very, like, no one's covering my song. Like, that's my song. You can't cover my song.
Really? But, I did listen to that song, the Tracy Chapman version, 2 days ago.
Oh, it's a great song. I mean, it's a great song. She has every right to do that. But Luke Combs specifically wanted to cover it. And he, like, went to her and he was like, "Hey, I'm not doing this for money," because apparently it was, like, a big song for him and his dad growing up.
Aww.
And so he's like, "I just want to sing your song. Like, I don't want to do anything to it. I just want to sing your song." And she's like, "Okay, but you have to keep everything exactly the same." And so he keeps, like, all of the words exactly the same, including where she's like, it's like living in the city with as a pickup girl or something like that. Like,
checkout
girl. Yeah. So, like, he has to keep all of the words the same.
I actually like that.
Because I appreciate him.
I know. Well, and I think when Tracy Chapman,
he gets, like, none of
that,
the royalties for it, too. It all goes back to her. He just is like, "I don't care. Like, I just want to sing your song." That's... Yeah. Which I have a lot of respect for.
I have a ton of respect for that, actually. Like, I don't think I've ever heard of someone doing that. They probably have. I've just never heard of it. But, like...
Well, not in, like, such a big way. Like,
well, yeah, to acknowledge, like, "Hey, you did the hard work. You wrote the song. You made it popular. Yeah. I just want to do the song."
Yeah,
you
can have everything. To me.
Yeah, like, that feels like art. Like, supporting artists.
I want to appreciate you.
Yeah.
And what you've done for me. So... Anyway, this was not that. She took these songs and she completely flipped them on her head. Not, like, just by changing how they sounded, but the fact that she was purely a woman singing them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for the most part, she was one of the first women to take these traditional songs and actually sing them in a way that she kind of could make a name for. So she worked really, really hard, earned herself her career. She definitely did. And by her 30s, she was seeing some pretty relative success. She wasn't, like, super big yet, but she's making her name for herself.
Okay.
And more than just in her music, she is, like, well known by fans for her kind of, I don't want to say outrageous personality, but she was definitely
larger than
spitfire.
Life.
Yeah. Throughout her life, she drank heavily, which we'll see later, but it does kind of catch up with her eventually.
Okay.
She was known for carrying a gun everywhere, smoking cigars, getting into fights, like, until she was, like, in her 70s, she was pulling all this stuff. She really was, like, she didn't come around to, she was
not their best friend, yeah.
No, yeah. And she also became pretty enmeshed in the Mexico City's, like, kind of bohemian scene. Okay. So this is the 50s by this point, the 50s and 60s. And so that kind of, like, subculture of people who aren't necessarily part of that 50s and 60s ideal, which I know is, like, pretty predominantly American, but it definitely affects the rest of the world.
Yes.
And so she's in this alternative subculture. And one of the most obvious ways she's in this alternative subculture is she dresses exclusively in men's clothing.
Interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Specifically, she wears, like, all the time, she has a serape that is, like, traditionally worn by men,
mm-hmm.
that she wears all the time. Like, she wears pants, she goes full nine, like, commits to, but she still identifies as a woman.
I am curious, did she ever go on record that you know of that said, like, "I did this because it's comfortable," versus "I did this as a statement"?
We'll see later.
Okay.
Man, I just saw a freaking gnat. I hope the gnats aren't back. I need to...
What a mood.
I need to get my gnat killer 3000. What another thing she also did that kind of was revolutionary in her style of music is that she would never change the pronouns of her songs. So when they were love songs, a man to a woman, she'd sing that.
Oh.
Keep those she, her in there.
Okay.
So hint, hint, nudge, nudge.
Mm-hmm.
She had some proclivities.
Yes.
She would specifically, the thing, how she would change the style of the song would go from like upbeat, kind of like that typical like Mexican sounding music, like mariachi that we all kind of know, or at least maybe we know because we're from Texas. Yeah. But she would slow down the tempo of the melodies, and she would also like do it without a big band, how they were traditionally played. She
sorry,
would
that was me moving my mic if y'all heard any interruptions. Sorry.
She would slow it down, and it would usually just be her and like her guitar.
So like acoustic cover kind of vibes?
Yeah. Okay. And really slow it down and really drawn out like the dramatic tension of the songs.
Okay.
Sometimes in serious ways, and sometimes because it just kind of made it amusing and funny and more entertaining. So she becomes really popular, and by the end of the 50s and into the 60s, she's, you know, playing in big tourist attractions. People know her. She releases her first album called Noche de Bohemia, or Bohemian Night, in 1961, who, with the like support of one of the foremost writers of Mexican ranchera music, Jose Jimenez. Jose Alfredo Jimenez, and like these two were besties. They were friends, and oh. Jose Alfredo Jimenez, from what I've seen, is like a hugely, hugely influential name in Hispanic music.
Okay.
And so the fact that like she was in the same league as him is a huge deal. She would go on to record more than 80 albums.
Whoa.
80. She found major success in the 60s and into the 70s, and went on tour in Mexico, the United States, France, and Spain. And she kind of rubbed elbows with all of the artistic people that were in Mexico at the time, including Juan Rulfo, Agustin Lara, and Frida Kahlo and her husband, Diego Rivera.
When you said earlier that she had polio, mm-hmm. I immediately thought of Frida Kahlo.
So... you should have, because her and Miss Kahlo seem to have gotten up to something more than friendship.
Is that why I recognize this woman's name?
You might, yeah. That's I why. Almost wondered if you would have, yeah.
Because I did that episode on Frida Kahlo. Yeah,
that's what I was thinking.
Hold on, let me see. Keep going. I'm going to go back through my notes and see if this is the woman who I recognize.
And this is allegedly, this next part is allegedly. So is the Frida Kahlo thing, but this next part is big allegedly. So apparently she sang at Elizabeth Taylor's marriage to Mike Todd, one of her marriages.
Ooh.
And after her performance at the wedding, you know, because Elizabeth Taylor is obviously connected in Hollywood, American Hollywood.
Ooh. Dude, you have got with these cords. Don't fuss at me when you get yourself tangled up and I have to fix it. Okay? I'm helping you. But Mom.
Anyway. So supposedly at some point during the night, she is said to have run off to have an illicit affair with none other than Ava Gardner.
Oh.
I know. And let me tell you, this woman apparently got around. She was known for, like, seducing, like, politicians' wives when they came to, like, visit and stuff. Like, she... Let's just say she's no stranger to the one-night stand, it seems like.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Unfortunately, though, during this time, her alcoholism is just worsening throughout the 60s and 70s. And eventually, in the 70s, she ends up retiring. And she spends 15 years recovering from her addiction to alcohol. And she's kind of nursed back to health. And she's so off the map that literally, apparently, people in her life... like thought she died. Like,
oh, Lord.
They were like, we have not heard from you in 15 years.
Oh,
like,
my gosh.
She totally goes off the map. And then 2 decades later, when she is like in her 80s, I guess it would have been the 90s. So in her 70s. Anyway, she's old. She's getting up there. She makes her public comeback. And this is like one of the biggest parts of her career. This blows her into fame, and she gets international recognition at this point. And she's in her 70s. Like, talk about late bloomer. Good for you. Like, never give up on that. Like, who knows when it's going to happen for you. And she's touring around North America and the world, and she plays her first show in Carnegie Hall, and she won several Grammys, and she's, again, in her 70s and 80s, which is so impressive. And then, at the age of 81, she writes an autobiography called And If You Want to Know About My Past.
Oh, that's a kind of cool name.
Yeah. And this autobiography is where she first, for the first time, publicly confirms that she is a lesbian.
Oh.
So good for you, queen.
Wow.
Yeah. Unfortunately, though, she can't, you know, go on forever. And in 2012, she gets sick. She has some respiratory problems, and she has to be hospitalized. And eventually does die because of these issues in Cuernavaca, Mexico. And according to her official Facebook page, because this is 2012, which kind of threw me when I was doing these.
Yeah, that's so weird.
I know. I was like, whoa. Her last words are said to be, quote, "I leave with Mexico in my heart." On August 12th of 2012, her funeral was held in Plaza Garibaldi in the center of Mexico City. Hundreds of her fans and loved ones gathered in honor to, like, celebrate her legacy, where they played her music and drank her favorite drink, tequila. Her ashes were eventually scattered in the Chalchi Hills in Morelos, Mexico. And on February 10th, 2017, a biographical film, so a bio on her, comes out called Chavela Debuts. It's written by two female directors, and, you know, it's just kind of an examination of her whole life. And I wish I could have found it to watch it, because that would have been really cool. But it's out there. So if you're interested in this topic, I would definitely recommend. And in August of 2019, she was one of the honorees inducted to the Rainbow Honor Walk in San Francisco, which I've mentioned that before when I talk about other LGBTQ history figures. Usually they'll get a place on it's kind of like the Walk of Fame, but for gay people.
Yeah.
So good for them. And it's in San Francisco. And apparently a quote that she would often say is, quote, "Human beings love, and that's all that matters. Don't ask them who they love or why."
And that
is Chavela Vargas. And she seems like a really cool lady. And I wish that, you know, this was a longer bio, because what a badass.
I know.
Good for you.
Every time you do a musician, I always end up, like, wanting to go listen to their, like, discography.
I know.
So I know what I'll have to listen to after this.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe not all 80 albums, but...
That might be a little bit much for
the
me.
The one that I kept seeing, like, her biggest album was La Llorona. That seemed like her kind of biggest hit. I think it actually came out in the 90s. So it was when she came back that it was popular. Yeah.
Okay.
So she definitely did not fade to obscurity. She fought off alcoholism, and she was said to have been sober until the day she died. So good for you.
That's really impressive. Yeah. Especially in that, like, stardom, in that, like, lineup. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talked about it a few weeks ago when you were doing Janis Joplin, like,
yeah,
what is it called, the 27 Club or
whatever? Yeah.
Like, there is such a cultural, mm-hmm, like
it's just around you all the time.
Yeah,
like, yeah, it's hard to avoid it when it's constantly there,
and to, like, have that problem for a good chunk of your career,
mm-hmm,
and still be able to kick it. The longer you have an addiction, the harder it is to kick.
Yeah,
like, that's so really impressive. That's, yeah, really cool.
So it was a short one, but like I said, I think she definitely deserves to be talked about, and I was happy to do an episode on her for Hispanic Heritage Month this year. And yeah,
that's awesome.
I hope you learned something and found someone new to appreciate.
I definitely did. I think musicians are, like, when we do bios, especially you, I don't know if I've done a bio of a musician yet. I just think it's so cool, too, because, like, they're such a cultural,
yeah,
thing. Like, they're not like, oh, I invented this one thing that is
right,
so, like, iconic to, you know,
whatever. I know. It's like, I can't really talk about, like, what if this lady had never lived? Like, okay.
But at the same time, it's, like, so...
It is, like, definitely a cultural history moment there.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that she was born in 1919, and in the 1950s, she was able to kind of make a name for herself despite her not being the 1950s ideal is really cool and interesting. And it's fascinating to think about, like, what made her earn a name when she did, because obviously, like, were people looking for something other than that
right.
50s idyllic, you know, men were men and women were women yeah. attitude. And what does that say about the people? Were they craving something different than that? Were other people feeling those feelings? And this is the only way they could express it is listening to her music, you know?
Right.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Also, I did just, I did just look. I don't see that. I don't see her name.
You might have found it, like,
in the Frida Kahlo
when you were, like, notes. Doing notes.
I know. So I might have. Yeah, that might be. Yeah. I might have read it a couple times and maybe I didn't include it. But the episode we found Frida Kahlo was 32. It's almost 100 episodes ago.
Oh my God.
And I was, like, scrolling through all my notes and I was like, why can't I find it? Why can't I find it? And I was looking in, like, the 90s. It is 100 episodes ago. So that threw me off, and now I'm going to have an existential crisis. But, you know, talking about movie stars and cultural history, or music stars, I kind of want to do maybe a theme we should do is
that's a good
stars.
Idea. Yeah.
We should do like movies or movie stars or something like that.
Yeah.
Culturally significant. We've talked about film. We've talked about, we did Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
And
I did that one about Yellowface.
Yeah. So, that would be a fun,
that would be fun.
A fun one. Something with
yeah,
film
we'll
history.
Have to keep that. Yeah. We'll have to keep that in mind.
Yeah. Well,
oh, man.
Yeah. So. We've got lots to do and lots to talk about still. And we'll be hitting you with more history next week as well. I don't think next week's a thing.
No.
This was 37?
It'll be 38.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll find something really cool for Hispanic Heritage Month.
Yeah.
I had a couple written down that I really wanted to talk about at some point, so
nice.
We'll do that. But yeah. If you want to tell us what you want to hear, which we always want to know, you can tweet at us at DINAHL podcast.
Or you can email us at thisisnotahistorylecture@gmail.com.
We love to hear back, and we also love to hear what you think in your reviews. Every review you leave is one more Reese's Peanut Butter Cup that I get to steal.
There you go. It's not stealing if I give it to you.
I know, and I will replenish at some point.
I'm going to, like, go upstairs to grab something, and Kat's going to be sneaking it out of my candy bowl that I have for guests to take from.
I would. But yeah, I feel like there's something we're forgetting. Maybe it's just because it's been a little while since we recorded.
I think that's everything. So,
alrighty.
We appreciate you listening, and we hope you learned something. And as always,
this has not been
a history
lecture. Bye. Bye.